I'm Dave Baker.
And I'm Andrew Price.
Welcome to Deep Cuts, the podcast where we pick a topic and walk you through the ins, the outs, and the nitty-gritty so you can appear like an interesting and idiosyncratic person at your next forced social function. Today's topic is...
Cynthia Rothrock.
Who is Cynthia Rothrock? Well, she's a world-class martial artist who holds 7 different black belts. She's also been the star of over 40 feature films. With physical ability and on-screen persona that's hard as nails, she should become a household name. But unfortunately, damn, she should have become. She should have become a household name, but unfortunately, that didn't happen. On March 8th, 1957, in Wilmington, Delaware, Cynthia Ann Christine was a rambunctious child. After her family moved to Scranton, Pennsylvania, she began taking martial arts classes. Can you imagine if The Office had starred Cynthia Rothrock? It would have been a way, way better show. Also, way more mullets. Also, way more high kicks. And way more beckoning with your front fingers at a bunch of people to come attack you. At age 21, Cynthia married a kung fu instructor named Ernest Rothrock. She quickly made a name for herself in the international martial arts scene. She took world championships in forms and weapons every year from 1981 to 1985. And just so we're clear, forms and weapons are two separate martial arts practices, and they don't actually involve combat. They do involve more like exhibitionist formal displays of the craft. So it's more kind of like
the bodybuilding.
Yeah, it's kind of like look at me do this high kick and like look how perfectly my legs are in a straight line, or like look at me use this. You know, these nunchucks or this crazy whatever that weapon is, where it's like a stick with a sword on the end of the stick. Yeah, so she took world championships every year for 4 years in a row in the 80s, which is nuts. This was something of an anomaly in the late 70s and early 80s for a white woman to be at the top of the sport, obviously. She had black belts, like a lot of black belts, in Tang Soo Do, Taekwondo, Eagle Claw, Wushu, Northern Shaolin, Ying, Yin, Kung Fu, Pai Lim, White Dragon Kung Fu, and like 2 or 3 others, I think.
Are there any, is that a thing anymore where just like a random white person just becomes like a master of martial arts? Is that like that used to happen all the time? That was just a thing that happened a lot in the 70s.
But I mean, you're kind of conflating two things. There's because the thing that you're talking about is like here in America, we would take notice of a white person in air quotes becoming a master at something because we're in America and... You know, prior to the late 60s, early 70s, we weren't really interested or even aware of the various martial arts.
Yeah.
And then, you know, certain people like Bruce Lee, Chuck Norris helped popularize. Because like Chuck Norris learned Taekwondo when he was in the military in Korea. And then he brought it back here and opened a bunch of dojos. Like before he was a movie star and before he was a stuntman, he was just like a small business owner where he opened like a string of Taekwondo, might not have been Taekwondo, but I'm pretty sure it was Taekwondo, martial arts, you know, dojos. And he would just like teach people like kind of the basics of everything. And that happened with a lot of people. That's how Bruce Lee paid rent for a long ass time, is he like taught people martial arts, you know, when he was over here trying to get his acting thing started.
Yeah.
But I think the reason is because like there's just entrenched racism surrounding some of these things. So when there's an Asian person who is objectively a master at the craft, it doesn't get as much signal, you know, as somebody who is.
Well, that's kind of what I mean is like nowadays.
Yeah, there's just no need for that because we're aware of what these practices and, you know, this medium is, and B, I was about to say more open to, we're not. We're still as xenophobic and shitty and racist as we always were.
Yeah, but instead, like, that may not be much improved, but ultimately, if somebody was like, oh, this white person that's like a master of this, people would be viewed as very problematic.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I think it's just...
I mean, I think the conversation around cultural appropriation and martial arts has definitely increased in volume over the, you know, 4 or 5 decades that it's been popular here in the States, for sure. It's, you know, obviously it existed way before that, but just with the proliferation of movies and the proliferation of like the 70s kung fu explosion and Shaw Brothers movies being imported over here and Bruce Lee becoming an American icon, like all of those things dovetail into a broader understanding of it.
And I guess my question is the feedback loop of that increased understanding and awareness and then increased scrutiny of cultural appropriation led to less like white people like getting into these things and wanting to be like a martial arts expert, because it doesn't seem as much of a, number one, doesn't seem as much of a novel thing to do, and number two, it's like, you know, it's kind of like I don't want to be the white person with dreadlocks or whatever.
Right. I don't know. That's a good question. I think there's also, you know, not that there aren't people still obviously excelling in these crafts, but the real estate that is dedicated to action martial arts films in America specifically, just in America. Obviously, there's still massive industries in you know, the East, but here in America, it's not as much a thing. You know, now action movies are just kind of like the nice guy who has abs that we can put a cacophony of CG around.
Yeah.
You know, so it's just the models have just shifted, you know. Like there was a point in time where it's like if you wanted to be an action star, you had to know some sort of martial arts. Like that was the thing. Mm-hmm. We need to be able to, have you ever placed in a martial arts competition? Because we need to be able to sell this movie off of the back of you being a kickboxing semifinalist, you know?
Now you can just be like, we're a family.
Yeah.
We got to drive together because we're a family.
Yeah, pretty much. Or like, there's a storm coming and they won't know what hit them. Or other, you know, vague platitudes like that in the trailer, you know? Yeah.
Don't you know I'm back for revenge? Jim from The Office can become a huge action star.
They offered him Captain America. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
How weird is that? Nuts, you know? They offered the guy who put a fucking banana in his butt from Not Another Teen Movie Captain America.
Yeah, I mean, that's all so strange.
Yeah, and he's like arguably one of the biggest action stars on the planet.
Yep.
I guess that's maybe a little bit different because I don't know if I would say any of those guys are action. They're superheroes though, which is almost a step above now. Like that level of kind of, you know, the pervasiveness of directed VHS action movies, all that real estate has just been subsumed by like shitty comic book movies.
Yeah.
Well, shitty superhero movies specifically.
Now it's like with visual effects and what we can do technologically, you can make, you know, Chris Evans is obviously a specimen of a human being.
Yeah.
Visually.
Yes.
But in terms of a person, somebody who has no experience or training in any kind of combat or anything like that.
Yeah.
And you can turn that person, just an actor, into a huge action star by just crafting that around them. And they just have to look really good. As opposed to back then, you have somebody like Sammo Hung, who just like looks like a human frog man.
Yeah. He looks like a drunk uncle.
But he's badass.
Oh, he's so badass. Yeah. In 1983, Cynthia Rothrock was part of Ernie Reyes' West Coast demonstration team, which if you're unfamiliar with Ernie Reyes, he's the pizza delivery guy from Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. And he's also the suit actor for, I don't remember, was it Donatello he was the suit actor for?
Yes, he was the suit actor for Donatello.
Yeah. And so he's kind of another one of those. I would say he's probably just above this, the kind of the level that Cynthia Rothrock kind of climaxed at. You know, there was like, in the 90s, there was this massive influx of direct-to-VHS martial arts movies. And, you know, you had these stars of these movies, people like Don the Dragon Wilson, Olivier Gruner, and Cynthia Rothrock, among many, many, many others. But they kind of all filled a template, right? They were like, I am a former martial artist. I won some championships. Usually, honestly, Cynthia Rothrock is kind of an aberration in this because it's usually kickboxing. Like, I don't know what it is about kickboxers, but there's a lot of fuckers who won kickboxing tournaments that then became like C-list action stars. But Ernie Reyes is like just above that. He's like, you know, he's like, isn't he in like Batman Returns? Oh, no, Don the Dragon Wilson is in Batman Returns. Ernie Reyes is in one of the Batman movies as like a fucking gangbangery dude who Batman punches, you know, 1 second. And they like all these guys kind of have a role like that where you're in one shot of an A-list movie. And like that was your one time to really like do your high kick or your, you know, Jean-Claude Van Damme splits or whatever it is that you were going to do. And if the producer was there that day and really liked you, you actually might have a career. And if they weren't, then you went and worked for Roger Corman or, you know, Empire Pictures, or, you know, Charlie Band, one of these kind of like direct to VHS schlock masters, and they just signed you up to like a 13 film contract and you just produced a shitload of movies.
The modern day equivalent of that, which is kind of different because it's more of a half step going from this to movies, is professional wrestlers.
Yeah.
Like I said, that's a little different because they're already sort of doing this theatrical thing that,
yeah,
number one, they've qualified that they're at least some element of good at acting, and it's,
or at least if not acting, performing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wrestlers and, like, to a certain degree, MMA fighters like Gina Carano.
Yeah.
That's kind of the benefactor of that now. That's
yeah,
the thing
totally.
That happens.
Whereas like if Gina Carano or what's her name? She's in the Fast and Furious movies too. Blonde. She was a MMA fighter. Ronda Rousey. Like those types of people, if this was 1991, they wouldn't be starring in Star Wars movies. They would be in, you know, Gina Carano is the Revengist.
Yeah.
You know, or, you know, Ronda Rousey's had enough of your shit and now she's coming for your skull. You know, like that's all those movies are that
yeah.
thing. You know, the trailer or the box art is them holding a gun and there's a building that's on fire and somebody's in the bottom corner of the VHS box kicking. Like, regardless of the genre, it could take place all in a jungle. There's a building on fire, a large shot of somebody's head holding a gun, and somebody kicking. That's just all these movies are.
Yeah.
You could almost swap out the titles, which a lot of them do. Like a lot of these movies and these VHS franchises, they would just make a bunch of movies and then slot them together in a franchise if they got traction with one of the movies. Like Don the Dragon Wilson had a whole career based off of these films called Blood Fist. And the first Blood Fist movie was actually titled Blood Fist. And it's basically just poor man's Enter the Dragon, but with all of the cast members in the movie being martial arts champions or kickboxing champions from the last couple years. So there's like the Olympic gold medalist in kickboxing, the actual, you know, kickboxing champion, which was Don the Dragon Wilson. He's the star. Then you have, you know, the 1989 you know, fucking kung fu guy, the karate guy from 1987, and like you just put them all in a movie, none of them can really act, and then they just punch each other, and then the movie's over. A lot of these movies, you would make, you know, X amount of movies, and then you would start releasing them, and if you got one of them that was a hit, then you just piled onto that one. And so all of the Blood Fist movies, I think there's seven of them, all Blood Fist movies that basically made Don the Dragon Wilson's career. None of them were intended to be Blood Fist movies. They were just titled that. And they are so disparate that Blood Fist 3 was intended to be an actual theatrical film that was a real movie where it was like them in a prison. It's basically a prison drama script starring Richard fucking Roundtree. Shaft. Shaft is the fucking like big draw in this movie. But they just last minute put Don the Dragon Wilson in the movie. So it's a heartfelt drama about life in prison. And then at three points in the movie, the beginning, the middle, and the end, there's just kickboxing fights. And that's just what you did.
Yeah.
You know, because you just, what do we got to do to get the financing? Oh, we're making a sequel to Blood Fist. Well, the character's name is different. It doesn't matter. It's a sequel to Blood Fist. And all the Blood Fist movies are like that. Like, they're just kind of a script that somebody had that they could figure out how to put kickboxing in somewhere. Like, I think it's either the second or the fourth one. I don't remember because they get kind of jumbled because they're all, you know, they are what they are. It's a case of mistaken identity where Don the Dragon Wilson is a LoJack guy, but somebody thinks that he's stealing a car in the opening scene of the movie. So they try to come and like, that's my car, stop stealing it. And then they have a kickboxing fight on the front lawn of this guy's house. Why? Because everybody knows how to kickbox. And that's kind of the aesthetic of these movies. And that's honestly, that's why they're so kind of charming to me, because they all have this weird, like almost meta narrative that just like everybody in the world is physically prepared for anything. So you gotta just be on your game always.
It's, yeah, it's this great form of magical realism.
That's completely unintentional, but
yeah,
wonderful.
That I think the movie that, you know, we'll talk about that sort of kickstarted Cynthia Rothrock's career.
Yeah.
Has it in spades.
Yes.
And it's we'll get into it, but it's great.
So in 1983, she joins Ernie Reyes's West Coast demonstration team. While at an exhibition match, a producer for Golden Harvest, the famed production company that produces like a shitload of movies, saw Rothrock and was like, you kid, you need to be in the moving pictures, see? And 2 years later, Cynthia Rothrock would star in...
Yes, Madam.
Which is a bizarre title for what is a fucking awesome movie.
I fucking love it.
Yeah, yeah. It's so good.
Remember the episode about A Message from Space?
Yeah.
Where I was kind of like, this is the opposite. I fucking love this movie.
Yeah, it's so good, right?
It's so fucking good.
Yeah.
Listen, Dave, the only question to answer is which one of us is Michelle...
Michelle Yeoh
and which Michelle Yeoh and which one of us is Cynthia Rothrock?
That is a really good question, and I feel like... I don't really know. They're kind of... Their characters aren't all that defined in the movie.
They are, though, because Cynthia Rothrock, she's a tough-as-nails foreign police officer who doesn't want... Who isn't about bullshitting around with the criminals.
Yeah.
And she thinks that you have to get in there and force the truth out of them.
Yeah.
And Michelle Yeoh is a sly, by the books, but secretly kind of on the back end, not by the books, detective who's always one step ahead of everybody.
Which one do you want? You can just have whichever one you want. I kind of want Cynthia Rothrock, but whichever one you want, you can have.
I feel like you're maybe a little bit more of a Michelle Yeoh.
Okay,
if I'm
sure.
being honest.
Yeah, sure. Is it my lack of mullet?
I mean, she's got something brewing up there.
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah, she really does. Or is it because I'm slender and you're surprised that I can kick as much ass as I can because I look like a beauty queen?
It's an energy. I'm not going for the physical thing here. It's just there's like these essences that
I take that as a high compliment because Michelle Yeoh is regal as fuck.
Yeah.
You know who's not typically regal as fuck? Me. But I will take that compliment.
And the name of the movie, because, you know, there's like the alternate title, which is like, you always love to see that.
Where
it's
yes.
like, Yes, Madam, a.k.a. Police Assassin 2, Streets of Dragon...
Death or whatever. Yeah.
But I don't know when we're going to talk about this, but I have this grander theory about this movie. And I think that Yes, Madam... plays into it, and it's the exact appropriate title for this movie.
So as Andrew just said, the title of the movie is Yes, Madam, and it was also released under the alternate title Police Assassins. And I feel like it was released in Malaysia as well, but it was released in the UK as Police Assassins. It was Yes, Madam is a 1985 Hong Kong martial arts crime film directed by Corey Yoon. The film stars former beauty queen Michelle Yeoh, who you know from movies like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, television shows like Star Trek Discovery, and everything ever. The wedding movie that I've seen, and I can't remember the title of now, that she was just in last year, that huge, successful... The fuck is the name of that movie?
Crazy Rich Asian?
Yes. She's amazing.
I know we're talking about Cynthia Rothrock, but...
We could do a whole episode just on Michelle Yeoh. She's amazing.
But Michelle Yeoh in this movie?
Yeah. Yes. She is the emphatic nodding. She is so cool. She is so cool in this movie. And the crazy part is she wasn't a martial artist before this. Like, she learned all of this shit and launched an entire career as a martial artist. Because she does martial arts in a shitload of movies off of this movie. Like, literally, she was a fucking beauty queen before this.
And her part of the combat in this is definitely noticeably less technically proficient. And Cynthia Rothrock is doing the lion's share. But even Michelle Yeoh, and this is just a testament to... once again, about going back to Message from Space and my issues with that, this is a testament to just the balls to the wall bravery of Chinese filmmaking.
Yeah.
Some of the, even though her martial arts stuff in this is obviously kind of number one, aided by editing, and number two, you know, just not as proficient as Cynthia Rothrock. She does a couple of stunts in this that are like, I mean, my favorite stunt in the whole movie is from her.
Which one is your favorite?
When she flies leg first down the giant staircase and just full on body kicks the guy across the room. And it's like real.
Yeah, it's great. My favorite one from her is when they're fighting on that second level and there's like a glass partition on the banister. She's up on the banister and then she drops down and catches her legs on the banister and swings reverse through the glass up and then grabs his legs.
Yeah.
Oh, man. I mean, obviously it's sugar glass, but fuck me.
Yeah.
When I saw that shit, I was like, you are so awesome. You're so awesome. And honestly, that's kind of what every shot in this movie that either of them are in, you just it's are just like, you're awesome.
That's why I said, I wasn't joking when I said, I wasn't making like some dumb joke when I said like, which one of us is which. I meant it. I want to be these characters. I want to make this movie and I want to play these characters. The magical realism of it, like, and there's John Woo talks about this in like, I think it was the commentary, one of the commentaries for Hard Boiled, and they were just talking. He was talking about one of the villains in the movie and how whenever they were shooting the movie, they kept coming up with like shots. They were just trying to like come up with like the coolest visual shots they could come up with for like making the characters like look really cool. And so a lot of the shots of the villain, like it was just that actor, he was just coming up with ideas to like just make himself look really cool. And I feel like that is kind of like an overarching theme in Chinese action and kung fu cinema, is like they just really go out of their way to create like aesthetically pleasing, and not from like a cinematography standpoint, but from just like just making their actors just look really cool, especially in the 80s. And I feel like every moment in this movie with the two lead characters is just that, of like, what is the coolest fucking thing you can think of? There's a scene, once again, going back to magical realism, where Michelle Yeoh walks out of a building with her sort of lackeys in tow. She's dressed in this just garish 80s neon outfit, and she just has one hand in a pocket, and she just strolls out. And it's like, no, it's nobody would ever do that. Like it's like literally like she's a fashion model. Like it's, yeah, like it's a fashion model walking down a catwalk.
But it's so rad, though.
And it's like, it's just the coolest fucking shot.
Yeah.
And then there are just these scenes, especially when the two of them get together, where there's just these awesome shots where it's just them back to back putting up their fists. And it's like, this is just so fucking cool.
I mean,
everything about this is so fucking cool.
And that's such a trope, too, of right, of like, you start off as like disgruntled frenemies and then you have to team up against a thing, right? But the way it happens in this movie, where so much of it is just kind of done with like guys running into a room holding guns or with swords or whatever, and like they just kind of like look at each other and they're like, all right, let's fucking punch the shit out of these dudes. Like, it's so fucking great.
Yeah.
Like, I, and also like, obviously Michelle Yeoh has screen presence because she's like one of the biggest movie stars in the world, right? Like, she's gone on to do hundreds of movies and she's amazing.
Yeah.
But it's so impressive that Cynthia Rothrock, because in, you know, some of the other Cynthia Rothrock movies, you know, she's good, but she's kind of like, she's the best thing in the movie. And there's nothing for her to like really try and climb over. You know what I mean? Like, nobody's fighting her for the screen. It's a Cynthia Rothrock movie. Even when, yeah, she's not the main character in a movie, you're always like, who the fuck was that? Whoa, she was cool. Like, you know, she's the, what's that adage? There are no small actors, just small parts or something.
Yeah.
It's a perfect example of that. Like, she fucking owns everything she's in. But in this movie, and it's so kind of heartbreaking that she never really had another movie that challenged her in this way, obviously. Like, she's so, you can tell she's fighting for the screen with Michelle Yeoh, mm-hmm, and that it makes both of them better.
Yeah.
And like, she never got another movie like this. Like, her, the rest of her oeuvre is kind of, they are what they are, which I like, though. I like a lot of them. And she's great in everything. But there's something about being challenged and being forced to do your best work that maybe, you know, making a schlocky Roger Corman movie in 2 weeks isn't going to bring out your best, you know?
Yeah. At that point, you're just kind of whatever is in the can is what it is.
Yeah.
I have to say, though, something that occurred to me as I was watching and I was like, something is familiar about this. Cynthia Rothrock looks like a combination of Patricia Arquette and David Duchovny.
That is the most bizarre thing you've ever said. I don't disagree,
but
that is really bizarre.
I see that in her face.
Yeah, except she's more emotive than David Duchovny. Shots fired!
Especially in that first couple seasons of X-Files.
Or the one where his dad dies and he has to cry. And he can't do it, so he just buries his head in his elbow and he's like,
Well, even by then he had gotten a little bit better. But in those first two seasons, it was like,
pretty wooden.
This is a guy.
Yep.
You know they got the pizza man to be the star of this show.
You know who's not that though? Gillian Anderson.
Nope.
She's amazing.
She's great.
She's amazing. So anyway, Michelle Yeoh stars as Senior Inspector Ng, who is who's forced to team up with Inspector Carrie Morris, played by Cynthia Rothrock, to obtain a microfiche film that has been stolen unknowingly by a lower tier gang members. And honestly, anytime there's microfilm, microfiche, any sort of weird old technology, I love it.
I mean, even just going like little touches, like 80s cinema tropes that we just have completely abandoned that I just wish would come back. Like every time that the microfiche gets revealed on camera, there's that little musical cue, the bring, like that little like ominous like chime.
Yep.
Like we don't do that anymore. There's no like little like suspenseful music chime whenever a plot MacGuffin is revealed.
Yeah.
And it's so, it's just like, it's just telling, it's like the score is telling you,
this is the
here's this thing.
Here's the thing that we're all looking
for.
But
it's so great.
Yeah, I agree. And like we've been talking about, the direction is so kinetic and so like energetic that one, they're both great. Two, the action is really fun. The choreography is really, really nice. But the way everything is shot with, you know, speed ramping cameras and guys running
high frame rates.
The guy is running at the action as it's happening and then yanking the camera back as somebody falls into it. You know, the quick cuts being purposeful quick cuts and not like how so many modern movies where it's like Paul Greengrass style shaky cam and then just like 50 cuts in the course of 50 seconds to just disorient the viewer. Like it's all, you know, contact cut based. So whenever a punch lands, then you're cutting to an opposing angle, or when the action reframes, then you're establishing a new line. So the camera's on the left and then, you know, scuffle, 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 characters stand back up again. And now the camera reorients and now it's on the right to establish a new paradigm of power between the two characters. Like it's so well thought out, you know, and the movie's not a big budgeted movie either. It's not like they have like millions of dollars.
Yeah, and the martial arts choreography isn't it's not the most proficient or inspired, you know, of all time. But I think it might be some of the most fun.
Yeah, it's really fun.
Martial arts and action choreography in one of these Chinese
action movies. It's so fun too because Cynthia Rothrock's haircut is amazing.
Yeah.
And every time she does something with that stupid little mullet thing, it just makes me so happy.
It's everything about the movie is just so aesthetically perfect.
Yeah.
Or just not, maybe not aesthetically perfect, but aesthetically exactly in my wheelhouse.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Aesthetically perfect to me.
Yeah. Or even like Michelle Yeoh's like baby blue overcoat from the middle of the movie. I think it's the middle of the movie. It's so, so fun. Because it is so not self-aware. Like it is to the hilt trying to do the thing. And I love that it's not ironically doing the thing. It's not like, yeah, this is the action movie with the ladies.
Yeah.
It's a fucking balls-to-the-wall action movie. And the leads are female. Commence punching. Like, and also the weird supporting characters are so funny and great and like,
I mean,
the actors are so idiosyncratic.
Yeah, I was literally just going to use the word, the movie is very idiosyncratic. And not only that, but like I said before, I have a theory about how this all ties together and why these things are all the way that they are.
Maybe I could just list a couple of these things and you can give them a rating out of 10, from 1 to 10 mullets, how many you would give them.
1 to 10 mullets. Yeah.
So the kineticness of the directing, 1 to 10.
10 mullets.
The charisma of the leads.
Borderline 11 mullets.
The 80s haircuts.
15 mullets.
The fact that Michelle Yeoh did all her own stunts.
Infinite mullets.
There's a scene where Rothrock has to rip her skirt in order to do a high kick, which I'm always a fan of ripping some piece of clothing to do something. I love ripping a sleeve off in order to punch somebody. I love unbuttoning a shirt in order to punch somebody. Ripping, you don't see people ripping pants that much, but ripping a skirt is always fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love that as a symbol of just like, I am aware that social decorum requires me to stay within these bounds, and I will not stay within these bounds. Let's get this fucking shit done. I love that. I love it so much.
I mean, the pinnacle of that being in the movie Lucky Stars, when the Japanese fighter is wearing that like traditional kimono, and then she disrobes, and then she's just a fucking like ripped ass, buff ass bodybuilder.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So should we go through the history of these movies and the kind of subgenre that it spawns a little bit, or do you want to talk about your thing right now?
Let's go through that and then
okay.
It can sort of dovetail into that.
So the combination of Yes, Madam, which then leads to Police Story 3 Super Cop, which has Michelle Yeoh as one of the leads, and Holy Weapon.
Also great.
Yes.
Great movies.
Yes. They basically kind of cement Michelle Yeoh as a superstar. Like, kind of without these three movies, Michelle Yeoh could have easily have been Cynthia Rothrock. Like, if Cynthia Rothrock had starred in Police Story 3 and Holy Weapon, we might be doing an episode about Michelle Yeoh right now.
Yeah.
The movie Yes, Madam actually made like a shitload of money at the box office, and it launched a franchise. And I know you're looking at the outline right now, but if you hadn't seen what's coming up in the outline right now, what would you guess with the name of the franchise that Yes, Madam spawned would be?
I mean, I think you're there's a loaded. You're asking me to the answer that you want is Yes, Madam, right?
I mean, I was
Yes, Madam too.
Yeah, you would think that it would spawn a franchise around the phrase Yes, Madam, but it doesn't at all, because none of these martial arts, and specifically, you know, direct to VHS martial arts movies, they always have bizarre titles that have nothing to do. They're just kind of like generic, like.
Plus, that title is so specific to the movie.
Yeah, absolutely. So it spawns a franchise called In the Line of Duty, which is the most bland franchise title ever. And the individual movies within that franchise, the first one is Yes, Madam. The second one is Royal Warriors, which was also put out under the title Police Assassins. So there are two movies put out under the title. Yes, Madam and Royal Warriors were both put out as Police Assassins. Then In the Line of Duty 3, so there never wasn't In the Line of Duty 2. In the Line of Duty 3 was also released under the title Force of the Dragon. In the Line of Duty 4, which was released in the UK as just In the Line of Duty, which stars a young Donnie Yen. And then the fifth movie is titled Middleman. Middleman. I love it. Also in the UK released as In the Line of Duty 5:Middleman. In Line of Duty 6? No. It's Seawolves.
Seawolves.
Seawolves is In the Line of Duty 6. And then and then next up, we're returning to the old title, Yes, Madam, 92: A Serious Shock. And then the seventh movie in the franchise is released under the title Yes, Madam 5. Even though it's 7, it's released as Yes, Madam 5.
And there's only, and it doesn't even make sense because there's only, it's only the third Yes, Madam titled movie. So even that doesn't make sense.
Yeah, the math is just wrong on every level.
It's so funny because, you know, back in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, less or so in the 90s, but, you know, there really wasn't any established infrastructure for movie continuity the way that we have it now, where everything, you know, it's like it has to be built into this living
larger
machine,
yeah.
And the title has to like make sense within this larger infrastructure. But, you know, really back then it was the titling of movies was all driven by distribution channels. So it's like whatever this movie needs to be named in order to sell well on VHS, that's what we're going to call it.
Yep, pretty much. That's why you get things where it's, you know, there's like, you know, Puppet Master 5, and then the theatrical movie being called Puppet Master the Movie, even though it's Puppet Master 6. And there's like all of this weird, just complete bullshit. Also, Puppet Master the Movie never was released. I'm aware. I'm just saying when it was going to be made, it was going to be called Puppet Master the Movie. Like, It's just so bizarre. And I kind of love it. Like, I really love complicated bullshit franchisey stuff like this.
Yeah.
It makes me so happy because it feels like life. Like, you never plan life. Like, I love when a franchise has an installment that's titled the final something or the last something, like the final chapter or, you know, Nightmare on Elm Street, Freddy's dead. The last one. Like, no, it's not.
Yeah.
No, it's not. I know it's not going to be.
I mean, they literally, they had announced the trilogy of the other two Halloween movies after the most recent one.
Yeah.
And the last one is called Halloween Ends.
Yeah.
And then they like immediately said it wasn't the last one.
Yeah.
Like they didn't even pretend.
Yeah.
Even before the movie's made, they didn't even pretend like it's really going to be the last one.
Yeah. So fucking funny. So, you know, Yes, Madam is very successful and it kind of spawns a new subgenre of Hong Kong films. This subgenre
is... Also, by the way, before you go on to that, the original Yes, Madam, if you didn't know, was written by a guy named Barry Wong, and he wrote Hard Boiled.
And
Twin Dragons.
Yes, Madam spawns a subgenre of Hong Kong films, which is often referred to as the Girls with Guns subgenre. Other movies in this genre include Women on the Run, The Inspector Wears Skirts, which there are not one, not two, not three, but four Inspector Wears Skirts movies. The first couple, which I really like, Dreaming in Reality, Her Name is a Cat. Oh, Her Name is Cat. Sorry. Blonde Fury, Iron Angel, Black Cat 2, : The Assassination of President Yeltsin, which I feel like that title pretty much just, it says it all. And these movies, for probably about, you know, a decade, maybe 8 years, they kind of just dominated a corner of the martial arts movie market. Like, every martial arts movie that got made from, like, 1982 to 1995 or so, you know, sporadically with, you know, waves, was just one of these movies where you take a, you know, a cool martial arts trained woman, sometimes not even a martial arts trained woman, but just, like, a cute girl, and you put them in a crime scenario, and then they just beat the living fuck out of everybody, and they kind of are, you know, the character archetypes are usually, you know, it's what you think it is. It's, I have a gun, I'm in, you know, some sort of police or detective character, and I'm no nonsense, and I'm not going to take any of your shit, and I'm going to shoot everybody. Some other actresses who came up during this time that are of note are Cynthia Khan, known for appearing in The Line of Duty. She's in 5 of the 7 in the Line of Duty movies. She's also in Queen's High, and The Evening Quartet. Cynthia Khan is awesome. She's super cool, but I'm not going to front. I kind of like all these people I'm going to talk about very briefly are really, really neat. And I highly encourage you to go check out their movies. But Cynthia Rothrock is the best. I love her so much. Moon Lee is kind of like the TV or the small screen version of this kind of archetype of woman. She got her big break in a movie called Iron Eagles, aka Angels, aka Iron Angels, which is basically kind of an Asian Charlie's Angels style thing. And then she kind of parlayed that success into 30 Girls with Guns movies. Yes, Madam would set Cynthia Rothrock up as one of the kind of promising talents of the martial arts world. And in 1985 alone, she would star in Yes, Madam, 24 Hours to Midnight, and Defend Yourself. And after this ad break, we will talk about Defend Yourself because it's fucking amazing.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Before we talk about Defend Yourself, should we talk about your theory of Yes, Madam now?
Yes. So kind of opening up the whole thing about this movie starting the girls with guns genre even wider. Now, I admit that I'm not an expert, and I admit that I didn't do as extensive research as I could have. I could have spent days poring over endless Wikipedia pages and digging deep into random websites to try to like really get an expert sense of this. But, you know, I spent a couple hours and kind of did my best in the short amount of time I allocated, which is all to say that I'm sure there's somebody out there who's going to be like, well, actually, in 1981, there was. But I kind of presented this to you as a theory the other day through text, and you were kind of like, oh, I don't know if that's really exactly true. But I did some research, and it's from what I could find. This movie, Yes, Madam, seems to be one of genuinely the first completely female-led, female-driven action movies with a capital A. There, you know, in doing my research, like, of course, there are precursors, you know, most notably, you know, a few years before this, there was Alien that was kind of like kind of universally regarded as like one of the first female action heroes. But I would say that Alien is not an action movie. It's a horror movie. And then there's even like people who talk about how like female action stars date back to like 1912 when they had like the like Annie Oakley appearing in short silent films where she's like, you know, chasing bad guys and shooting guns out of their hands and things like that. But in terms of like capital A action movies, as we understand them, the lineage of what we accept as an action movie, I really was hard pressed to find anything that existed before this movie that was just completely starred and was exclusively female driven as like the main driving hero slash heroines of the movie. And so another thing that I noticed about the movie, and I picked up on it kind of like in the second half of watching it, and so much so that I actually watched it again to take notes on this. But throughout this movie, I picked up on this. If this movie had been written by women, or it had been made even a few years later in the late 80s slash early 90s, then I wouldn't think this, because that was sort of like getting into, you know, the late 80s, early 90s was getting into, you know, this second wave masculine female action hero trend that happened then. But considering the fact that this movie predates that and it was written and directed by all dudes, I get the strong sense that somebody who was involved in the writing of this movie had an extreme humiliation fetish. And if you aren't familiar, there is a large community of in the fetish community. There is a large community of men who basically get off on being humiliated and embarrassed by women. And as I was watching this movie, it just occurred to me that this movie just felt very much like it has this central thrust of like men being embarrassed and humiliated and dominated by women. Like the movie literally starts, like the opening minute of the movie is a man, like a creepy flasher guy, exposing himself to Michelle Yeoh, and then she claps his dick in a book. She turns around, he goes, whips out his dick, and then she slams it, a book onto it. That's like the smash to credits moment in the movie. Every character, this movie is, you know, it has these two central characters, Michelle Yeoh and Cynthia Rothrock, as the two main characters. And they're both these like strong, charismatic, confident people, that sort of always have like control of the situation, and they always know what their next step is. And they seem to be like one step ahead of everybody at every turn. And then every other character in the movie is this just incompetent, hilariously doofy guy. And that's both the criminals as well as the cops. Every other character is just this like inept, goofy, kind of pervy dude. There are so many other examples of this that come up. The entire movie hinges around two competent women surrounded by bumbling, idiotic men. There are constantly situations where like overly confident guys kind of like stroll into a situation like, oh, you're just a woman. And then they just get their asses kicked and it's like humiliating for them. And everyone, like literally just scenes of people, of crowds of people laughing at people. There's like several moments in this movie where like a crowd of people just point and laugh at a man being humiliated. And even going to like the main villain of the movie and then the end of the movie, you know, spoiler alerts for if you haven't seen this movie yet, but the main villain of the movie is this like comedically evil businessman who literally laughs like, ha, 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 ha. And he's like this overly confident guy who at every step of the movie, he's like, you can't touch me because I'm a rich man. And then it all culminates to like they have this big fight. This whole thing happens at the end of the movie. The police come. They can't find the microfiche. The guy thinks he's getting away. The two women, as well as these other two guys that are helping them out, get arrested because they've sort of trespassed in his building. And he kind of walks away like, ha ha, like this is what happens when you are a rich, successful man. You get away with whatever you want. And then literally first of all, as a side note, I love the ending of this movie because the movie, the direction you think it's going is that like, because they have this microfiche, the guy is hiding it in his mouth and then they get it and then they burn it. And then that's like the evidence that gets destroyed. And then the police come and they're like, you're trespassing. They arrest everybody and the guy gets away free. And what you think is going to happen is that there's going to be some kind of reversal where the guy who's like, that wasn't actually the real microfiche. I have the real one right here. And then they catch him or whatever. But that doesn't happen. The microfiche that got burned was the real one. There is no hope of incriminating this guy. And so instead of that, they just pull out a gun and kill him. Like as a last ditch effort, one of the guys is like, fuck this. I'm not going to jail while this guy walks away free. And he just grabs a gun and shoots him. And that's the way the movie ends. Like that's why this movie can't really have a continuation because it's implied that like they killed him and they're all going to jail. Like they're just going to go to prison for murdering this guy, even though he was a bad guy and he was evil. But that's like the culmination of the movie is this like man being like humiliated in the ultimate way. And so I really, you know, at its surface level, I think that this movie as inventive and exciting and inventive. Did I say inventive already?
As inventive and exciting and inventive and exciting and inventive and exciting.
As inventive, exciting, and unique as this movie is in terms of the staging of the combat, the choices, like the guy's dick getting trapped into the book as the opening of the movie, which is like a really interesting, exciting opening shot to a movie. I also think that the one of the writers of the movie like had this fetish where he fetishizes being humiliated and dominated by strong, powerful women. Even there's like a scene where there's these three dudes that are like in a mental institution or something, and like this woman comes in and like wheeling in this cart. And then like it has like a chicken on it and they're not supposed to eat oily foods or something like that. But then they like attack her and like steal the chicken from her. And they all like these three dudes just huddle around this chicken on the floor and they just start like just feverishly and like just eating this chicken as fast as they can. And then this like really domineering head nurse comes in and she's like, spit it out. And they all spit it out and they kind of like look like little like injured puppies in the corner. And then she takes it away from them and she's like, from now on, I control you. Like every moment of this movie is like bleeding with this like humiliation domination thing to the point where it's just like somebody was processing something when they wrote this movie. So that all being said, considering that this was a precursor to the late 80s, early 90s second wave masculine feminine action hero, the entire genre of second wave masculine feminine action heroes might have been started by a dude with a just extreme domination humiliation fetish.
Yeah, I mean when you had texted me about this originally, I was like, the first thing that pops into my mind is, one, I don't know what it says about me that I didn't put those things together originally, because I was just so in love with both of them. I just like you said, I just wanted to be Cynthia Rothrock or Michelle Yeoh so bad.
Well, that's the thing is when you watch it, it reads, and I'm not trying to diminish this aspect of it, but when you watch it, it reads as two badass women just being badasses and kicking ass. But I think it almost like maybe accidentally circumstantially came off like that when it was actually sort of rooted in this dude just like...
this like domination and...
Yeah, like, yeah. Like this domination fixation.
Yeah, it's
and
funny.
It just also played as this archetype that developed into this massive trend in the late 80s, early 90s.
So I have two thoughts on that. One of them being that all of this stuff that you're talking about reminds me of William Moulton Marston, the guy who created Wonder Woman, he co-created Wonder Woman, and he also created the lie detector test. And his worldview is exactly what you're talking about. He was into bondage. He was into kink play involving being tied up. He thought that people's true selves emerged when they were tied up, which is why Diana, Princess of the Amazons, has a lasso that when she ties people up, they tell the truth.
Yeah.
It's all of the early Wonder Woman comics are bondage fetishes. She's always getting tied up or tying other people up. She never hurts anybody or does anything against somebody's will. But like I said, you know, you get tied up and then it reveals who your true character is, you know, either through the lasso or you get tied up and you're like, please don't hurt me. I'll tell you where the Nazis are or whatever. In real life, William Moulton Marston had two live-in partners who he had children with both of them. They all lived together for the entirety of his life. And then when he died, his two female partners lived together as a romantic couple until they both died and they raised the kids together. And, you know, I mean, obviously this is an extreme lifestyle for 2020, let alone 1939 or 41. And so it's funny how so many people don't know that about Wonder Woman and they don't think anything of the lasso or her, you know, every part of her costume is symbolic to that identity, right? She wears a tiara because women are stronger than men and should be in power, or at least that's his, you know, ideal behind it. Mm-hmm. She wears bracelets because they look like former shackles because women used to be under the control of men, but now she's taken that experience and learned from it, and now she can literally reflect their aggressions back at mankind, bouncing their bullets off of her gauntlets. And it's funny how those, or it's fascinating how those specific ideological proclivities and also sexual fetishes dovetail into a story that the metaphors are transformed into something that go over most people's heads, right? And then the other part of this is something that my comics friends and I joke around about a lot, which is called the Claremont window. And the Claremont window is when whatever the span of time where your personal sexual fetish aligns with the current dominant trend in feminism. Because Chris Claremont's whole shtick was like, at a specific point in time, Kitty Pryde. He loves Kitty Pryde. He created Kitty Pryde. His whole thing is like young girls doing things and being self-actualized, but also kind of like in a weird, creepy sort of like, you know, we see what you're doing here, buddy. You're getting some demons out on those pages.
Yeah.
But that's kind of what you're describing with Yes, Madam. Is it they aligned with the Claremont window? You know what I mean? Yeah. They were at the right place at the right time, and
it just worked. And
yes,
to the point where it read as just badass, strong, independent women just being badasses and kicking people's asses.
Just Joss Whedon would be a perfect example of that too, where there was a specific window in time where the thing that he was into made a lot of sense culturally.
Yeah.
And now you're kind of like, oh, you're kind of creepy.
Yeah.
This is kind of creepy. Oh, it's kind of weird.
But there's something... there's something interesting or kind of cool about that sort of being reclaimed and reinterpreted. I mean, I'm not speaking about Joss Whedon, but speaking about whether it's Wonder Woman or Yes, Madam, of like maybe it started off that way, but it was sort of taken and became its own thing.
Yeah,
it
absolutely. And I think the Yes, Madam thing is distinctly different from the Moulton Marsden thing, because I think the Marsden thing is very nuanced, and it reflects an alternate lifestyle at a time where that made you a social pariah. Mm-hmm. And also he was a psychiatrist. And also those two women that he lived with, you know, his, for all intents and purposes, his wives were also in a relationship. It wasn't like a polygamy situation. Like in many ways, they were the platonic ideal of the throuple that so many dumb hipsters are like, yeah, we have an open relationship. Like they legit did, you know what yeah. I mean? Like they raised kids together and shit. And I don't know. I'm just fascinated by those three people, Olive Byrne, Elizabeth Marsden and William Moulton Marsden. I think it's a very interesting dynamic, which I don't think you find that many public records of. In fact, they made a movie about it too, which is called like Mr. Marsden and the Wonder Women, which I haven't seen. I have like next to no interest in it.
Yeah, I think this was an example of a guy who got an extreme amount of satisfaction from getting to watch a scene filmed where Michelle Yeoh,
the Tarantino window,
clapped a guy's dick in a book.
Yeah, I think so too.
And he went, oh!
Yep, I think that's 100% what happened.
I gotta admit though, it worked for me as well.
Did you watch any of Defend Yourself?
I did, a little bit.
I would describe Defend Yourself as like, what if David Lynch and John Woo co-directed a self-defense class video?
Yeah.
Like the opening of the self-defense video is slow motion, Cynthia Rothrock walking across a soundstage where there's fog going across the floor and there's like a one wall set and she's like walking, pretending to just be a normal person, walking home alone at night. And some guy comes up to her and tries to take her purse. And all of this is in slow motion. Every shot is in slow motion. And she kicks him in the groin and then palms his nose and then scratches his face. He tries to punch her and she parries it. And then they like martial arts duel for a minute, all in slow motion with synths playing over it. Like, it's amazing. It's so good. And then it kind of just becomes a typical martial arts instruction class. But with these interstitial slow motion fights, it's great. Like, I kind of almost love Defend Yourself almost as much as Yes, Madam. Like, it's such a bizarre, like, artifact.
Yeah.
I wish there was more self-help videos like this. Like, YouTube videos, they don't have the same appeal.
No.
Yeah. Anyway.
If every tutorial could be done in that style.
Can you imagine? Hey, guys, this is Caleb. This is my how to use Photoshop video. Please like and subscribe. Click. Click. Stroke. It's just him speed painting. Yeah, exactly.
Click, 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 stroke, stroke, click, click, stroke.
Like, I would watch 15 minutes of somebody drawing in slow motion. I wouldn't really. That sounds awful. But, like, yeah, that'd be great. So from here, Cynthia Rothrock's career kind of solidifies itself. She becomes a bona fide Hong Kong movie star. This is an exceedingly rare thing for a Western Caucasian actor to actually, you know, find a place in the Hong Kong film market, as you would probably assume. Over the next few years, Rothrock releases such films as Millionaire Express, which is also released under the title Shanghai Express, Magic Crystal, which is a movie that has a dope title and is fine, Fight to Win, a.k.a. Dangerous Passages, a.k.a. Eyes of the Dragon, which is a movie I like. 1987 brings No Retreat, No Surrender 2, which is a big kind of like watershed moment for her, because that movie gets released over here pretty wide, actually. I don't remember if it had a limited theatrical run or if it was a full theatrical run, but that movie like actually does some stuff. I'm not going to say that it catapults her to fame and fortune, but it gets seen by Americans as opposed to most of these other movies, which weren't seen by Americans until much later when the VHS imports came. The best titled movie in her oeuvre, The Inspector Wears Skirts, Rapid Fire, Jungle Heat, Righting Wrongs 2, Blonde Fury, a.k.a. Above the Law 2, which I have not seen but has been on my list for a long time, City Cops, and 1990, which is her kind of, this was her blood fist. Like, 1990 was kind of her make or break year. She was going to either become a mainstay direct-to-VHS superstar or not. And they released China O'Brien 1 and 2, both got released in 1990. And I think they did.
That's how you do it. Just
make them. Both of them. Just bang, bang, shotgun that shit. I have not seen either of these, surprisingly. Again, they've been on both of them. They've been on my lists for a while, but I've never actually watched them. But they do well enough to launch her career. But they kind of, she doesn't ever really attain kind of, for better or for worse, I think the best case scenario for her, given the breaks that she got, was to be a Dawn the Dragon Wilson style. I'm a person who was in a bunch of direct-to-VHS movies, mm-hmm. which is what she got. That's kind of what she was. But she never really, I mean, he was in fucking 7 Bloodfist movies. And the most she ever was in was 3 Honor and Glory movies, which is cool. But, you know, yeah, so 1991 sees 3 Honor and Glory movies, then 2 Rage and Glory films, Lady Dragon 2, Eye for an Eye, Checkmate, and Tiger Claws 2. And that kind of, her arc kind of ends there, kind of like basically by the time the 90s had closed. She was pretty much not necessarily out of the game. She was in like, she pops up in like sitcoms, weirdly enough, here and there. She's like, you know, I think she's in like a couple episodes of like Married with Children, you know, or like, I'm sure that the episode, I haven't seen it, but I'm sure the episode is like, one of the kids goes to a dojo and she's the martial arts teacher, you know, it's that kind of stuff. But she basically kind of runs the gamut of this low budget world. And then she appears in a bunch of movies, has a good run, and then kind of, you know, unfortunately there's only so much work for an actor that's a martial arts actor when they get older. And then B, because she was never given a real big breakout movie other than Yes, Madam, her career kind of subsided. And, right now, which is super cool, she lives here in LA, and in Culver City, she runs a martial arts dojo, which as soon as I read that, I was like, so we're going to make a movie with Cynthia Rothrock now?
I mean, that's what I was just going to say, is like her career didn't come to an end because her best years are ahead of her.
Yep.
When we make a movie starring Cynthia Rothrock,
yep.
We can't pull Michelle Yeoh as much as I wish.
Yep. Put Cynthia Rothrock in Star Trek Discovery. Come on, guys. What are you doing? Yeah, it's cool that Michelle Yeoh plays the Empress of the Universe, but where's Cynthia Rothrock? Come on, we need a Yes, Madam reunion. Come on.
Come on.
Come on. So, you know, that's kind of the overarching span of Cynthia Rothrock's career. And I guess the question I would ask is right off the bat, like, there are so many people that are way more boring than she is now or ever was that have massive careers, like Steven fucking Seagal. Why the fuck wasn't she a massive movie star? She was so great. It bums me the fuck out.
Yeah, it does. And it's certain actors like that that it's so sad because it's like, it just feels like the majority of their career was just a wasted opportunity and they just weren't quite in the right place at the right time to utilize their time to grow a really impressive catalog. You know, somebody like Bob Hoskins, or it's like, mm-hmm. Bob Hoskins is fucking great, but like he got Who Framed Roger Rabbit, The Long Good Friday, a really good extended little cameo in Brazil, and like a couple of other things.
If you don't say the movie that I know that you need to say, I'll never forgive you. Come on, say it.
I mean, I'm thinking of Unleashed.
I actually do like him in Unleashed, but no, come on, man. Super Mario Brothers.
Oh,
come on.
That would have never even occurred to me to say that. But yeah, you know, he's so great, and it just feel like his catalog just feels so, he still feels so underutilized as an actor. They're so good, and it's not like that, it's not even that they were a one-hit wonder. They had consistent like work throughout the years, and throughout the decades, they had like a really great thing here, and then like 10 years later, a really great thing, but then for some reason, they just didn't seem to get as much bang for their buck, I guess. And it's like, it always is just so strange to me because it's like if I was making movies, like you better fucking bet I would have figured out a place for Bob Hoskins in my shit.
What the fuck is his name? Lady Bird, Lady Hawk, Blood of Heroes, Soldier, Blade Runner. What the fuck is his name? The screenwriter. I feel like that about him. What the fuck is that guy's name?
David Peoples.
David Webb Peoples.
Yeah.
I would put David Webb Peoples up against just about any screenwriter from any point in movie history. He's amazing.
Yeah.
And he hasn't actually had any real, like, 100% hit other than Unforgiven.
Yeah.
Because, obviously, the Blade Runner thing was, the release was so fucked up, and the movie wasn't, you know, it didn't make money originally, blah, 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 went on to become a classic.
Yeah, there are a lot of...
Blood of Heroes is an amazing movie. If you haven't seen it, Blood of Heroes is the unofficial sequel to Blade Runner. It's a post-apocalyptic football movie starring Rutger Hauer and Joan Chen, and it's fucking unbelievably good. It's brutal and poignant and depressing and a testament to the enduring power of the human will. It's great. It's one of my favorite movies. Highly recommend it. He wrote and directed it off of the kind of heat that he got from Blade Runner. And the movie fucking crashed and burned.
Yeah.
And it basically just tanked his career for the next decade.
And it just became one of those movies that you see on HBO when you're a kid.
Yep. It's so good.
Yeah, there's a lot of screenwriters like that from that era. It's like Bob Gale co-wrote one of the fucking most successful movie franchises of all time. And then just kind of never did anything else. He wrote one other movie.
And then David Koepp is over here just writing everything in the 90s, most of which wasn't very good.
Yeah. And then David O'Bannon.
Apparently we only like screenwriters that are named David.
Yeah, I just realized that. Yeah. That's so weird. I didn't even think about that.
And then there's David O. Russell.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, that guy.
But, not David O'Bannon, Dan O'Bannon. So it's
not all David. Yeah,
Dan O'Bannon. He wrote
Alien
and then
Return of the Living Dead.
Yeah. And then that was like kind of it.
Yeah. Yeah. He did a couple things here and there, but yeah, I think he had a lot of stuff that was unmade. Made some comics with Mobius. Seemed like a really curmudgeonly dude. Seemed really
fashion icon for the, button up shirt and, high water pants and suspenders look.
Oh man, yeah, yeah. If I had my druthers, I'd look like a besequined Dan O'Bannon. Yeah. That's what I would tell my private tailor.
Yep.
I want to look like Dan O'Bannon crossed with Liberace.
And he'd be like, I got you, fam.
Yeah. Comes back. It's like, look at these suspenders. They're all sequins. Sick.
But yeah, to go back to Cynthia Rothrock, it's the same thing where it's just like, oh man, especially with somebody in that line of work where her work was so physical. It's like the wasted years you could have done so much more.
Can you imagine if instead of Walker Texas Ranger being fucking Chump Change McRepublican Head, if it was her, if she was Walker?
I mean,
that would have been so much cooler.
I'd love that, especially considering that I fucking hate Chuck Norris.
Same.
That'd be great.
What are your thoughts on the fact that most of this genre kind of bubbles up through the physical media pipeline of VHS cassettes? Like, do you think that stuff like this can happen again with streaming? Or do you think it's tied to a physical object that's, like, shared with people?
So it's funny that you asked that because, so normally...
You're starting a VHS distribution ring.
Yes.
Cool.
So in general, I would say, I mean, it's definitely to the detriment because, I mean, in my experience, for me, every weird movie that I saw when I was a kid... was from one of two things. It was either going to the video store and just pouring through the side aisles, not the new release walls, but just like the genre aisles. And after you've watched all the main shit that's like recognizable, then you're just like, what else is in here? I watched all the Nightmare on Elm Street movies and all the Friday the 13th movies. And so what is this fucking basket case movie? Like stuff like that.
Frank Henenlotter.
Yeah.
He actually, Frank Henenlotter just directed a documentary that I've been really itching to see. Do you know who Mike Diana is?
Mm-mm.
So Mike Diana is the only cartoonist to ever be convicted of distributing illicit materials to minors through comics. He made zines. He was a janitor at a school in Florida. He made zines and he used the school Xerox machine to copy the zines. And to make a long story short...
I think you mean Zines.
Zines, right. My bad. To make a long story short, they ended up in the possession of some police officers. They thought that Mike Diana, because of the graphic nature of these zines, implicated himself in a local murder. They brought him in, talked to him, and they were obvious. It's obviously that he never killed anybody.
Mm-hmm.
But because of them seeing that he was a janitor at the school and made these zines, they were like, oh, you're distributing these around the school. And then... he got taken to jail and there was this massive court case And he ended up being convicted. And he is one of the punishments was that he was barred from drawing, like legally prohibited from drawing while living in the state of Florida.
Jesus.
It's fucking insane.
Yeah.
And Frank Hennenlotter, director of Frankenhooker and Basket Case 1, 2, and 3, just made a documentary about Mike Deanna. Yeah, I really want to see it. It played at Toronto like last year. So I'm hoping that maybe it'll get a streaming or a Blu-ray release or something soon.
I do too now.
That was so adorable. I do too now.
So that was the way that I discovered movies, and also tons of anime.
It's pronounced anime.
Oh yeah. Sorry. Japanimation.
Yes. Japanimation.
And then the second thing was that I had, HBO. And so you just would watch HBO at night and see a combination of weird movies that they have in their library and also all the softcore porn you could wish for.
Yeah.
You know, like that doesn't exist anymore. Our current media consumption is a selective opt-in style of media consumption. Number one, because there's so much shit that, you know, when we were kids, I talk about this a lot. My theory is the reason why kids who grew up in the 90s are more well-rounded pop culturally than later generations or even the generations that came before them is because we grew up in the dawn of the internet and more importantly, cable television. So when we were kids, all these cable channels popped up. And it was 24 hours of programming, but they didn't have enough original programming to fill the slots. So they would just, you know, play. They would basically just were blasting the history of cinema in television into our minds because they had 24 hours of time slots to fill. And all they could do was just go back through their catalog or catalogs that they've purchased. And, you know, that's where we, you know, got to see all these old movies that would be played on HBO or, you know, the Monster Vision, like old movies that we played with these horror hosts and things like that. Or like, you know, the Looney Tunes on Cartoon Network. Like there's no reason why kids growing up in the 90s should have ever had any kind of frame of reference for watching the Looney Tunes, these like shorts that were played in front of movies in the 40s. But those are as part of our nostalgic childhoods as anything else because they were playing alongside fucking Dexter's Lab and all this shit. So, you know, that sort of just sitting there and being shown just this random grab bag of things, that just doesn't exist anymore because the way that we consume media is you have to go and seek out what you want to watch. You go and you say, I would like to watch this. Where is it at? There's not really any concept of like, I'm going to go to Netflix and press the shuffle button.
I was actually just thinking about this cause I've been in a Jeremy Saulnier wormhole recently. So I watched, Blue Ruin, Hold the Dark, Green Room, Murder Party, basically on a loop.
Murder Party sucks.
I mean, look, man, I'm just trying to get my fix. All right. Like there's only so many movies the guy's made. I'm just trying to watch all of them. Mostly I've been watching Green Room over and over and over. Like, it's a thing now where Nicole's like, if I come over, you can't put that fucking movie on. It's insane to me that I would watch Murder Part. Literally, I watched it four times on Saturday. If I've watched a movie four times in one day, you'd think at the end of that movie, the card at the end of that movie would say, hey, do you want to watch another Jeremy Saulnier movie? Or do you want to watch Macon Blair's other movie? Fucking, I don't feel at home in this world anymore, considering he's the star of this movie and wrote Hold the Dark. Mm-hmm. Like, you want to see this? But no, it's just leading me to other Netflix shows because it's trying to get me to watch.
Yeah, it just wants you to watch The Witcher.
Yeah, exactly. Or it's trying to get me to watch whatever the new season of insert show here is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's not a thing. So that discoverability is just, it's just, if anything, that has been inherited by YouTube and like watching fucking weird explainers and shit. Yeah. But you know, it doesn't really exist for weird, obscure movies and TV shows. However, I will say to play devil's advocate to myself. So I wanted to watch, a movie. I wanted to watch a movie called, Horror Express.
Oh yeah. I love that. Is that the same? Is that Trans-Siberian Express? The Christopher Lee, Peter Cushing movie?
Yeah. With the alien Rasputin.
Yeah. So, I love that movie.
So it was.
Fucking Telly Savalas showing up at the end as a weird Cossack dude.
Yeah.
Fuck yeah. That movie rules.
Yeah. So I found out that it was available for free to watch on Tubi.
Yeah, I've been watching a lot of stuff on there.
And so I watched the movie, and then after the movie ended, it automatically started playing this other movie called Black Sunday.
Yeah, I love Black Sunday.
And I watched that. And then now it automatically is playing this movie called V-I-Y. And it's like this weird Russian vampire movie with, like, I haven't even watched the whole thing yet, so.
Oh, is that the crazy, it's like crazy practical effects?
Yeah, it's like.
I've never seen that, but like, so many people have told me to watch that movie. I can't believe that's on Tubi. It is.
It's like crazy ass, almost like.
It's like Russian Evil Dead or something?
Well, it's like German expressionism, like crazy.
Don't say anything more. Monsters. Yes, I've been meaning to watch that movie for years. Don't say anything
so
more.
So like.
Yes.
I was watching this movie and it did that. And like on this thing specifically on Tubi, it gave me this weird flashback to my childhood of watching HBO, where I was watching one movie and then just some other weird ass movie came on and I watched that. And then just some other weird ass movie came on and I started watching that.
I did that like 2 or 3 weeks ago. I was also watching Tubi, but I've been watching a bunch of, so I recently read, it came from the video store aisle, the history of the Full Moon Studios, and so I've been watching a bunch of those Full Moon movies because they have a distribution deal with Tubi. Most of them suck, like really, really suck. But some of the early ones are really fun, and there's one called I think it's called Desolation or Oblivion. I don't remember the name of it now, but it's like a science fiction western where it's like a, you know, there's like a giant animatronics or stop motion scorpion instead of like a, you know, a wolf that attacks this, you know, like alien Native American guy and alien cowboy guy. And the giant scorpion's like, meow, 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 and they have to shoot it with their laser six guns and shit. But I started watching, there's a ripoff Doctor Strange movie that they made starring Jeffrey Combs. And
I've seen like pictures of from
awesome.
That.
It's awesome. It's so cool.
I love just the look and the costume of him.
Yes, it's called Doctor. I should know this. I just watched the movie, but I don't remember its title now. It's Doctor Something. It's his name. But after that, it suggested that I watch. Have you seen this movie, The Visitor? John Huston is the star.
The Visitor. I don't think so.
It's fucking weird. And I was into it. Like, it's John Huston. I kind of don't even remember what it's about because I was kind of in and out of the room because I was like drawing for a while and then I was putzing around doing shit. But the soundtrack is like weird pulsing John Carpenter, like dee doo doo dee doo doo dee doo dee. And the stuff I was watching is just like weird shots of John Huston walking around and talking to people in an ominous tone. I was like, this is cool. I'm into this. But it's a perfect example of like, that's the kind of shit that you would just get at the fucking VHS, you know, the store or whatever, and take it home and you're like, wow, I guess we're going to find out what, you know, Faust is.
Yeah, you grab things just literally based on the cover and then secondarily the blurb.
Yep.
If those two things line up for you.
Yeah.
You're allowed to rent 3 movies per visit.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you choose those ones. And then if you find a fourth one, you really want it, you put it behind Buckaroo Banzai because you know that nobody's ever going to go there and move that.
I'm a little insulted right now.
We've already had this conversation. You said that exact same thing.
Did I really?
Yes.
Oh,
but the thing is that I'm saying that nobody else besides me would go and be looking behind Buckaroo Banzai.
For the record, I love Buckaroo Banzai, and Earl Mac Roush is a genius. And we should probably do an episode on him one day, so I won't say anything more. And on that note, I'm Dave Baker.
And I'm Andrew Price.
Please sub the show, and you can find me online at heydavebaker.com.
You can find me online at geocities.com/PokemonFanDBZ. Also, daprice.com.
I'm rage quitting the show. You're gonna have a new host next time.
I really wish I could find my old GeoCity site where it was a combination Dragon Ball Z Pokemon fan page. Cuts is a production by Boy Genius Media. If you'd like to find this show and others like it, please visit boygeniusmedia.com or deepcutspod.com.
If you want to join in on post-episode discussions, please join the Deep Cuts Podcast Facebook group. Finally, subscribe to our YouTube channel for additional video content.